White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Listeners to the International Jew Study Hour. It is Thursday, February 6, 2014. I am Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And this is episode 82, I think. I'm pretty sure it is. And we are really coming around the bend, listeners, to the finish line. There are only three chapters left, including this one. So I know you're all out there weeping now. It's going to feel strange not to have the International Jew to be talking about here on this network. What do you say about that, Hanny?
I don't know. I guess it's kind of like the Andy Griffith Show going off the air.
You always come up with the best comments I would never think of. Well, it has been a long run, you know, and of course this is not the last night of it, but it has been a long time, and it gets to me to feel like it's just regular, you know, not like it's something that's going to end. And it is coming to an end. I shouldn't be talking about this now because this is a long chapter, but we might do a wrap-up show after the last chapter, right? I think that would be in order. So, but anyway, tonight's chapter is a long dialogue or a speech by a Jew, and it's long, but it seems to go pretty fast. I read through it pretty fast, so there's not that much to comment about it. I don't think there is, although there'll be a few things. So I guess we better get started, huh, Hattie?
I guess so.
Yeah.
International Jew, Chapter 78. A Jew sees his people as others see them.
Ooh.
This week, we present another Jew's comment on his race and for the good of the race. Bert Levy has said these things before Jewish women's councils and B'nai B'rith lodges, and they will assist readers of this series to an understanding of some of the truer, though minority, influences which are at work in American Jewry. He sincerely exposes every obvious defect, and it is to be hoped that one day, with a sincere pen, he will go deeper. Mr. Levy's chosen title is For the Good of the Race. From a far-off land I came, a sad-eyed, pale-faced, poetic young Jew, with an unspeakable love of my people burning in my heart. Of Polish-Russian parentage, there was implanted in my nature an indefinable sorrow, born perhaps of my father's and my mother's persecution, which left me high-strung and sensitive to the anti-Semitic taunts of my schoolmates. Given to idle dreaming by some old abandoned shaft or roaming the deserted alluvial diggings of the little mining town of my youth, I would conjure up visions of that new world I had so often read about, that great country where there was no prejudice against my race, the New Jerusalem. Shyly hugging to my breast some borrowed American book or magazine, I would seek the shadows of the huge decaying poppet legs and dream over the pages containing many Jewish faces, and I read with pride and gratitude of the high places occupied by my people in music, art, literature, and the drama. Filled with Jewish names and good Jewish deeds was the story of this new Zion, and a longing to be among the great ones of my people took possession of me. Between my dear father and myself there was a bond of love, too sacred for words. And when I looked upon his dear face for the last time in this world, and bade him a sorrowful goodbye before my departure for the New Jerusalem, he held me close to his breast and whispered, Don't forget that you are a Jew, and if you need sympathy, love, or help, go to your own race and show your Arba Kanfoth.
According to Deuteronomy 22:12, the Jews are commanded to wear fringe upon four corners of their vestures, and this command is observed to the present day by wearing a special garment with these fringes, generally hidden by the ordinary clothes.
Well, you know, the reason for that is so that they know that they're separate. You know, it's to keep them aware that they're separate from other people who aren't Jews and don't wear this fringe under their clothes.
I carried my father's words across the ocean in my heart, and the memory of his tear-dimmed eyes and the pressure of his big loving arms has never left me. In fact, it is so strong at times that I find it hard to believe that he is not by my side telling me, in spite of many disappointments, that after all, the Jews are still my brethren and sisters. Words fail to describe my feelings as the beauties of the new world unfolded to me. In wonderful contrast to the melancholy aspect of my own country was the joyous color of Samoa, with its hallowed memories of Robert Louis Stevenson, lifted like some fairy veil out of the midst of the Pacific to give me a glimpse, as it were, of my dream of America, the New Jerusalem. Oh, the wonderful days and wonderful nights out on that vast blue expanse, where God and his stars seemed so near that one formed a good resolution with every throb of the great engine far down below. On one of those nights, I sat listening to someone playing in the music salon, and I was inwardly thanking the Creator that there was a Puccini in the world and that he had given us La Bohème. There we were, thousands of miles from anywhere, languidly rolling under a perfect moonlit sky, listening to the plaintive airs that Puccini had coined for Mimi. There was hardly a sound but the gentle lapping of the waves breaking against the vessel's side, till a slight commotion on deck up ahead caused some of the listeners to investigate. One of the passengers, an ex-Harvard man, returned with the remark, "Oh, it's only some damned Jew. He's fallen and hurt himself pretty badly." Like a smudge on some beautiful picture, this was anti-Semitic sentiment on such a night, and considering its source, I felt deeply grieved. As I was the only other Jew in the first cabin, I made my way to the stateroom, where they had carried the victim of the accident and found him to be a tender-hearted old man who, I subsequently learned, had spent a long life in acts of charity toward his fellow men and women, regardless of creed.
Okay, let me just break in here real quick. You know, he says now he's the only Jew in the first cabin, and he's talked about how he's familiar with Puccini and La Bohème, and he's... you know, all of this, and yet it sounded like he comes from some old poor place in Poland. He's Polish-Russian, you know, but he obviously came from a well-to-do family, and they sent him off to America to make his fortune, and you know, he had some, he had a good background to him, which is not the impression, you know, that we tend to get right in the beginning, right? And it's not the impression you get through the whole thing, and yet here he is, you know, he's the only Jew in the first cabin, so how did he get there? And then he makes friends with this guy. Well, go ahead. You know, I just wanted to point that out.
He was returning to end his days in Jerusalem, his Jerusalem, not the one of my dream, where he could touch again the beloved stones of the Wailing Wall. And the Wailing Wall, as I mentioned to you before the show, is actually not a Jewish structure. It's a wall of an old Roman fortress called Fort Antonia.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never hear that mentioned.
And later on, the Emperor Hadrian decreed it to be the site of a trash dump. Something in the old man's face, that something which was in the face of my father, my brother, that something which is in the face of every Jew, drew me to him, as it has drawn me to all Jews always. And I spent many intellectual hours by his bedside, picking up grains of wisdom which he had translated from the Talmud. I wished that the ex-Harvard man could have known that the old man's wrinkles were but the pathetic records of the massacres of his kith and kin which he had witnessed in his homeland, and that he daily prayed for death to efface the awful memories. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
God. Jesus Christ. Later on, the ex-Harvard man asked me to join in a deck game. I reminded him that I also was a damned Jew. "I'm sorry," he said. "I know what you refer to. That was an unfortunate slip I made the other night. Merely a figure of speech, I assure you." I found him a charming companion, and soon in a cozy corner of the smoking room, we became fast friends, and I tried to win him over to think better of our people. "I would like to hear your opinion of your fellow Jew after you have spent, say, 12 months in America," he said. "Since then, I have walked the length and breadth of the great cities of America, and my very soul has cried out to my fellow Jew, 'Suppress thyself!' The day I arrived in New York, I learned that my dearest friend, my father, had passed away. And naturally, my first thought was to say the Kaddish, a prayer of the Jewish liturgy recited by orphans for the welfare of the souls of their deceased parents, somewhat after the fashion of the Catholic Mass. Every male of Jewish blood at some time of his life recites this beautiful prayer. It does not matter how far one strays from the fold or how much one has denied the faith. There comes a time when the Jew in him asserts itself, and he says the Kaddish. Public prayer among Jews can be recited only in the presence of 10 males above the age of religious maturity, and this assembly is called a minyan. Surely in this great city I would easily find a minyan, I thought. So I followed the line of least resistance, like any stranger in a strange land, and sought out the Jewish names best known to the public. I called at a business house uptown with the name of a great Hebrew over the door. He was the great man of whom I read with such pride in the little mining town at the other end of the world. Yes, the same Jewish face depicted in the huge photograph in the lobby I had seen in the magazine I had hugged so lovingly at home. I made my way, full of hope, to his office, and was asked by a doorkeeper my mission. I explained, the doorkeeper was a Hebrew, that I desired to say Kaddish for my father, and that I wanted to form a minyan. With a sly wink, he passed me on to several Hebrew clerks and office boys, each of whom smiled, sneered, and made his little joke about my greenhorns, or about greenhorns. Then I was ushered with many grimaces into the presence of the big man. Just a minute's conversation convinced me that he was a Jew in appearance only, and that he had never known anything of the traditions, the romance, the art, or the literature of our race. He didn't exactly know what a minyan was, or pretended he didn't, but recommended me to one of our people, as he put it, who ran a very popular chop house
close by. I began to realize that I was a stranger among my own people, and that night, I walked the streets of Great New York with an aching heart. Everywhere in the hurrying crowds, I saw the faces of my brethren and sisters, thousands, hundreds of thousands of them, hurrying, pushing, shoving brethren they were, with all the tenderness, the friendship, and the Semitic look gone from their eyes. Oh God, I thought, are these the children of Israel? Is this the persecuted race, that people who had been scattered to the four corners of the earth? Hungry and weary, I made my way as if in a dream to the cafe of a great hotel. Everything in the huge room was glaringly false. Marble pillars, oak beams, flowers were all imitation. A big orchestra sat in a balcony with an artificial moon and a painted sky as background. Everywhere were lights, lights, and more lights. From table to table I went, but I was roughly reminded that this was reserved and that was reserved. Presently, glaringly gowned, bediamonded Jewish women, accompanied by equally vulgar Jewish men, filed in and occupied every seat, and between mouthfuls of food and drink, their bodies would sway to the voices of other Jews, who sang only of Mississippi and Georgia. How these people did laugh when they caught sight of my foreign clothes and my pale poetic face, and how they would have screamed with laughter had I shown them my Arba Kanfoth, that beautiful little token which my poor father had fondly imagined would have made me understood in the new world. Out into the night I went, and found myself struggling in a torrent of humanity. Every time I received an extra bump or harsh push, I looked only to see that my antagonist was a Hebrew. On the street, in the cars, in the subway, or at the soda fountain, wherever I saw my fellow Jews blatantly shouting and rudely pushing, I, in spite of my indignation, felt the love of my race uppermost in my heart, and I wanted to cry out, O Jew, dear brothers and sisters, suppress yourselves for the good of the race. Stand back for the good of the race. Never in the world have our people known such a free country as this, and it is a privilege to be here. But at times a great fear comes over me, that we are abusing that privilege. Amid the din of Jewish music and laughter, the newsboys are shouting the names of Jewish murderers, the Rosenthal case, the gunmen of the city, the bribe givers and the bribe takers depicted in the news sheets have Jewish countenances, the gambling house keepers, yes, yes, I know that there are Christians who are murderers, gamblers, and informers, but the Jew is a marked man. He is distinct, apart, so distinct in a crowd that in a crowd he is the first noticed. It is for this reason that I would have my brethren and sisters suppress themselves. Stand back. I would have real Jews take the worst of a bargain once in a while for the sake of the race. I would have them once in a while give up their seats in public conveyances, behave modestly in cafes, dress quietly, and give up the use of assumed Christian names. There is nothing so pathetic as the man who, with a Hebrew face assumes a Christian name. I never go to a public place without wishing that my fellow Jew would talk less and appear less ostentatious. When one Hebrew comes in late to a show, marches down the aisle, and on the front row deliberately obstructs the view of people in the audience as he stands slowly removing and folding his coat and gloves, he seems to cause more annoyance than if half a dozen Gentiles did the same thing. When a Jew stands aside and waits patiently at a ticket window, gives his seat to a lady on a streetcar, or behaves in a refined manner in any walk of life, he immediately makes friends for our people. Most of our people, I have found, have aggressive personalities. It is this aggressiveness which has enabled many immigrants to pass through Ellis Island to the ownership of a fine apartment house all within a couple of years. But sometimes this aggressiveness becomes absolutely cruel, crushing from the very soul all the tender elements which go to make up a happy life. Recently, I thought with much bitterness of my father's last words to me, "If you need sympathy, love, or help, go to your own race." Ill health overcame me, and I became involved in debt for a trifling amount. Each stage of my embarrassment and consequent suffering was contributed to by a brother Jew. First, the shyster lawyer, without principle or mercy. Then his brutal clerks, sly and grafting. Next, a collector, absolutely callous. Then the process server. And at last, the bouncer. Sans heart, sans soul, sans everything. If all these agents of misfortune were Gentiles, I could have borne it. But the greatest heartbreak of all was the fact that one and all of them were brother Jews. Why must a Jew always be in at the death, as it were? There came a time soon after this when I walked the streets almost penniless. Seeking work, I applied at the store of a wealthy Hebrew. I explained to the well-groomed proprietor that I was an Orthodox member of his race and appealed on that ground for a chance. He pooh-poohed the idea. "My dear fellow," he said, "these are the enlightened days when Judaism is not taken seriously. In fact, it doesn't pay. I am a Christian cultist. I meet nice people, and it helps my business." Here was a poor fool with his head like the ostrich's in the sand. I explained to him that being a Jew was not a question of religion, but a question of blood. I told him that if a Jewish leopard ceased visiting the synagogue to go to a Christian cultist chapel, it did not necessarily get rid of its spots. I left him scratching his head, and I also lost the chance of a job in his store.
He doesn't want any assimilation at all. I don't know what's the right thing here. I mean, you know, he wants Jews to behave better so that they are... don't give the race a bad name, but he's very much for Jews keeping to Jews and in their Jewish, culture and so on.
Well, he seems to be upset about the fact that he got, so to speak, screwed over by other Jews, and that then they wouldn't help him.
Yeah, because right here he's trying to get help based on the fact that they're fellow Jews, and that's the thing that bothers the rest of us so much. So this whole thing is kind of funny. You know, you have to kind of, you see that there's, everybody has a problem. Now, this other guys who become Christian, they call it Christian cultist. I noticed in this article here, and this speech by this Jew. It's because Christianity is a cult to them, but they go along with it because it's good for business, and they want to get all that Christian business. So, very interesting, really.
In and out of offices presided over by men with Jewish faces, I trudged all day. Most of these men, I subsequently learned, belonged to New Thought, Christian cultist, and other up-to-date churches and societies. It was good for their business. They called themselves Christians, but nature's marks cannot be changed like one's clothes. In the great theatrical districts, I found thousands of my fellow Jews who had grown rich overnight by coining perhaps a popular song that had pleased the cabaret mad crowd, or by ridiculous impersonations of their race upon the music hall stages. A good many of these were young men, sons of fathers and mothers who had been driven from their country with fire and sword. The mothers and fathers stayed at home blessing God every hour of the day and night for guiding them to such a country as this, while the sons and daughters are out at the theaters, in the halls and cabarets, singing songs of Dixie. Passing by in this great throng are prominent actors, critics, and playwrights, many under assumed names, simply because their own names are Jewish. Flashing across the horizon as I write is a notorious Jewish doctor with a consumption cure. He could have been famous and honored had he but suppressed himself, instead of which he, with his commercial instinct and his press agent methods, made more enemies for the race. Many Gentiles, I will admit, have had consumption cures, but it remained for one of our people to float companies and open institutions before the cure was even reported upon by the government. Tramping the city tired and weary of looking for friendly Jewish faces, I found myself near the city hall. I approached a milk station and bought a cent's worth of the most delicious milk I have ever tasted. A rough-looking fellow next to me said, as he smacked his lips, "Pretty good stuff, that." And perhaps noting that I was a stranger, he added, "The guy who is doing this milk thing is saving the babies, all right. He's some rich Jew. God bless him. I've got 3 babies of my own." I just want to point out that most Ashkenazi Jews cannot drink milk. So this is a little unusual.
Really?
Yeah, most Jews are lactose intolerant. Hungering to hear a Jew praised, I talked with this man for an hour, listening with keen enjoyment to the story of one of my race who had caused his millions to do good for the people irrespective of creed, and had kept himself suppressed. I learned of this Jew's efforts for the dying babies at home, and for his starving co-religionists in Palestine, and felt proud. Proud and happy for the first time, I sat in the little park watching the passing procession till I dozed off into a sound sleep. My happiness continued in my sleep, for I had a most beautiful dream. Before me, in my dream, passed a grand parade. It was a series of "For the Good of the Race" tableaux. All the prominent professional Jews headed the procession with their real names and the name of their race emblazoned upon silk banners in letters of gold. Then came all the Hebrew gambling housekeepers, bearing aloft broken roulette wheels, and other emblems of a discarded and disgraced business. Next in order was a large army of Hebrews who were professional bondsmen for arrested streetwalkers, headed by two crooked ward politicians carrying a huge streamer with the words, "Henceforth we will go to work." These men looked a little sad as they marched along, thinking of the easy money they were leaving behind. But the cheers of the multitude exulting over their great sacrifice somewhat atoned for their agony of mind. Next followed the amalgamated Jewish usurers, real estate and company promoters union. This part of the parade took 4 hours and a half to pass a given point. All the marchers had discarded their expensive clothing and their diamonds and were modestly attired. They had also discarded their automobiles. Many of the prominent men in this section carried flags and banners upon which were inscribed the legends, "We will not lie about values. We will not charge exorbitant interest," and "We will not water our stock." These inscriptions were received with incredulous looks of astonishment, and many of the crowd called out, "We're from Missouri," whatever that meant. Then came a beautiful torchlight brigade called the Hebrew Firebugs Union. Nearly all these men had their hair close-cropped and wore prison clothes, a fact which filled the crowd with relief. Next came that part of the procession which showed the greatest following among its marchers. It was the large army of Hebrew aggressives. Hundreds and thousands of them passed by with reformed looks upon their faces. Oh, I felt so happy as I read the buttons they wore and saw the flags they carried. Most of the streamers read, "We will suppress ourselves. We will stand back and keep quiet. We will be unostentatious." There they were, hundreds of well-known faces and types. End seat hogs, front seat hogs, loud talkers, inconsiderates, bargainers, and the terrible army of people that go to make up the crowd which is directly responsible for the anti-Semitic feeling. The line of them was miles long. I was awakened from my happy dream by a rude thump from a Jewish policeman who hurried me to a police station where I was surrounded by shyster lawyers, my brethren, who wanted money with which they could square other brethren. I could not gain the services of a Hebrew bondsman because I had no pull. A Hebrew magistrate called me a bum and a loafer for going to sleep in a public park. "Keep awake in the future," he said as I was roughly handled, or roughly bundled out of the court. "Keep awake." This is the worst advice he could have given me, for I was so happy asleep and dreaming that my brethren and sisters had reformed and had become real Jews for the sake of the race.
Well, here's the question, you know, what is a real Jew? He's saying that real Jews are like those people he left behind, I guess, like his father or whatever. But these people in America, these Jews in America, at least that he's run into so far, are not real Jews. Okay, so yeah. He's a Jew. You know, Tan would say he's a Jewish apologist.
He's also complaining because he's not getting his cut of the take, you could say.
Well, I don't know. I don't get that impression too much, but he just can't even find a job, he says. But he's kind of strange.
Well, some of there's at least a few of these Jewish truth-teller books are motivated by the fact that the particular Jew got burned by other Jews, you know?
He's not appreciating the way he's treated by these Jews because he doesn't want to be, he wants to suppress himself. He wants them to do that too.
I now look upon my police court humiliation as the best thing that could have happened to me. For a kindly old Jewish scholar who acted as court interpreter was attracted by my appearance. His long contact with human misery and his great experience with foreigners stranded in a strange country enabled him to understand me. That night, he took me to his poverty-stricken little room behind a delicatessen shop in the ghetto. After supper, he went to the street door and called the neighbors from their stoops. He called them by their first names, and I said Kaddish for my father.
You know, I think that's pronounced Kaddish.
Well,
did you look it up? Because it seems to me I've heard people say it, but I'm not for sure. I didn't look it up.
I don't know. Sounds more typically Jewy if I say Kaddish.
Well, I'm going to look it up right now while you're reading.
I said Kaddish for my father as they stood around among the pickled barrels. Since then, I have lived among Jews, real Jews. I have learned that beneath the ragged coat of a pushcart vendor, there may beat a heart of gold, and that a poor seller of collar buttons or suspenders may be a student of the Talmud with a mind that is a gift of the gods. Leaving the seething, modern, fashionable life of Upper Broadway to enter the religious atmosphere of the numerous schools of Jewish literature on the East Side entails a violent contrast in conditions.
Yep, it's Kaddish. Did you hear that?
Okay.
I put the sound on because I couldn't figure it out from the printed word, but yeah.
To see the deeply furrowed, time-scarred faces of the grand old men poring over their beloved Talmud is to get a glimpse of another world, a world of resignation, peace, and love. Within earshot of the thundering traffic of Broadway, I stood gazing at the bowed figures engaged in study and prayer. As I gazed, the sordid walls of the poverty-stricken room faded from my sight, and in their stead I saw, in my mind's eye, the wailing wall of Jerusalem, or some ruin of the holy city. A more fitting background to the rabbinical figures so strangely out of place in hustling America. The great passion for the dead and gone past, reflected in the Rembrandt-esque faces of the aged students, lends to their lives a religious grandeur which the uptown tourist, hastily passing on a rubberneck wagon, would never suspect. Behind many a shabby-looking little store, or maybe above some corner saloon, are the societies for the study of Hebrew literature, where congregate the types of Jewish scholars and philosophers that make the heart of the writer and artist glad. Gray-haired, bewhiskered, sad old men, many of whom have tasted only the bitterness of life. Yet such is their faith in the Almighty that they cling to the praying shawl and Bible to blot out the memory of a Kishinev. Their lives of study and prayer amid abject poverty, giving a lie to the fallacy that the Jew that the Jew lives but for money.
Well, see, there they bring up Kishinev again. That was brought up not too long ago, that supposed pogrom that was not as bad as it appears in their history. And there was also some other things to it. I read about that a long time ago, but I don't remember it. well enough. But they like to see this guy's really bringing up the old persecuted Jew and all these old Jewy, all these old guys, you know, sitting around doing nothing. They don't work. You know, these old time Jewish scholars supposedly sit around and read the Bible all the time. Their wives have to take care of the family, and they do. I don't even know if they go out and work where they get money from donations or something, but but their wives take care of everything, and they never know how to do anything except sit there in reading those books.
Yeah.
Seems sort of stupid to me.
And they're quite a class of parasite over in the State of Israel.
Yeah, they're parasites over there too.
I have often wandered among these scholars, picking up the crumbs of wisdom which fall from the lips of the old men, grateful that my Jewish face and blood gave me the privilege to sit and sketch among them. Somehow or other, my ramblings on the East Side are like the calm after the storm of the uptown struggle. Many times I have felt the heart tug, the longing to be among my people, the real Jews, and leaving theatrical uptown, the land of make-believe and unrest, I have sought the little schools of study where the wonderful real old men who live by optimism and nourish their souls by faith teach me the lesson of patience and the love of humanity. There is something restful and inspiring when an old man, long, long past the biblical 70, places his hand on your shoulder and murmurs in Yiddish, "It is God's will."
You should say it in Yiddish. Well, how do you say it in Yiddish? Yeah, you know German.
Es ist Gottes Willen.
Yeah, like, well, that's something like that.
I have envied the profound peace of many of these aged students living in the past and undisturbed by the God, by the thoughts of the future. Their Jewish view of life is as beautiful as it is simple. It disregards neither earth nor heaven. It looks to earth and observes the evil prevailing among men. It thinks of heaven and ponders on the bliss of the future state, and it urges man to strive to bring heaven on earth, to establish by justice and equity those blessed conditions on earth which so many associate with heaven. Well, that's starting to sound like communist talk.
Yeah.
Their Jewish view of death is equally beautiful. For those who die, they feel no sorrow. Having once torn aside the veil which parts the known and the unknown, having once entered into the shadow, or rather the sunshine of the beyond, they are better off in the other life. Whether death means eternal sleep or eternal life, those who have left our side, having passed into the arms of pitiless death, repose in a condition which should give survivors no cause for anxiety on account of their beloved dead. In the pathetic chapter of The Old Curiosity Shop, in which Dickens tells of the death of Little Nell, he makes the schoolmaster utter these words of wisdom, on which all who mourn for their dead may well ponder. "If," he said, "one deliberate wish expressed in solemn terms above the bed could call her back to life, which of us would utter it?"
So was the schoolmaster a Jew?
I don't know.
I don't either. I don't know this story.
Probably not. Okay. But I hadn't thought ahead about what kind of accent.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I was wondering about that anyway. If he's, you know, if he's using Jewish.
Okay. Dickens took this view of death from the Talmud. I wonder about that claim.
Jews want to take responsibility for everything.
Yeah. Well, it ends, this chapter ends up that way.
The interpretation of a difficult passage from the Talmud or the coining of an epigram is as food and wine to the wise old students, and there is not an ill in their lives that cannot be soothed or a blessing that cannot be acknowledged in a quotation from their beloved book.
Yeah, there you go. That's the truth.
To watch them at their study and devotions undisturbed by the turmoil about them is to marvel at the faith which has enabled some of them to live more than 100 years with no other interest in life than their God and their books. From the dingy windows of the schools, the mass of sordid buildings looks to their eyes like the hills of Palestine. And the shriek of the passing elevated trains and the clanging of the car bells and the din of passing traffic disturb them not, for they live in the past. The alleged Jew of the fashionable uptown lobster palaces, the blatant pushing type, who is the direct cause of much anti-Semitic feeling, knows and cares nothing for the submerged student of his race. The latter is equally oblivious of the alleged Jew, who is contemptuously referred to as a meshumad, or apostate. But while the former stands out in the world of money and worldly success as a target for much abuse and hatred, the latter lives with books, unknown and unheeded, drawing from the Talmud a joy that riches cannot buy, and solacing himself with the love of humanity.
How can you get the love of humanity from the Talmud? See, that the way they talk about this is there's a contradiction.
I don't know.
What they consider humanity, I guess.
I don't know. I mean,
you know, maybe... Well, maybe they find it loving when the goy falls in a ditch and you remove the ladder.
Well, no, yeah, they do. They think that once when the that the Jews have the answer, Judaism has the answer for everything, and that they have the answer for all humanity, and they don't really think past that. You know what the humanity wants.
Well, their idea of loving all humanity is that they're going to tell the rest of humanity what to do.
Yeah, exactly right. They're going to be...
While the rest of humanity brings their gold to them.
Right. But these old guys, they're so lost in this book, they don't even know about life, you know.
So in strong contrast to their fathers and grandfathers are the children of these old men. Modern America, with its opportunities for all, has torn them from the religious atmosphere and sent them uptown to become lawyers, artists, and actors. So he's blaming America's cultural milieu.
Yeah, for ruining...
Corrupting the Jews.
Yeah, corrupting the Jews, right. From the old country...
The Jewish comedian of the vaudeville theater, who nightly sets the audience shrieking at his Yiddish idioms, is in 9 cases out of 10 the son of a scholar. And though the glamour of Broadway success claims him, and he no longer lives home in his heart of hearts, he is a Jew, and never forgets the old people. He will tell many stories of his parents to his Gentile friends, imitating and exaggerating their many characteristics. But he is mighty sore when he hears a Gentile do the same thing. But after all, the comic Jew of the modern stage is but an imaginary sketch. There is absolutely nothing humorous in these old men of Judea, even in the sordid surroundings where you find them engaged in prayer or study. Their attitude is one of quiet dignity, a dignity enhanced by their extreme old age. In a little dark den behind a poultry store, I was sketching some of the old men at study. One old fellow, 104 years old, was explaining to a young fellow of 60 a passage in the Talmud about which the latter was in doubt. Both men were without coats. The younger man had left his pushcart at the door, entirely forgetting the perishable goods thereon, and quite oblivious to the fact that hundreds of dirty children were surrounding his cart and fooling with his wares.
Dirty Jewish children.
Maybe not Jewish.
Well, if he's in the Jewish section there, I don't know.
Other old men were in the school, and the background to their somber faces was the shop with its ghastly poultry suspended by the necks. One of the old Talmudic students would now and again leave his ponderous Bible to serve in the shop, returning, after wrapping a fowl in a newspaper, to the verse he had been propounding. There was absolutely nothing humorous in all this, but I would love to have had some of my non-Jewish friends see how little thought of money and business the real Jew has. Sometimes, when I have felt full of shame at the behavior in public places of men and women with Jewish faces, but with no Judaism in their hearts, I have wished that the simple, studious lives of the old men of the East Side could be the standard by which our race is judged, and that the Talmudic saying so aptly put into verse by Rabbi Myers was better known. Which is the path both right and wise that for himself a man should find? That which himself much dignifies and brings him honor from mankind.
What a great performance, Hattie. This was from...
Thank you.
7th of May, 1921.
I'm all
What? Go ahead. Give your response.
Yeah, nothing.
Oh, I'm done. Well, no, that's hard to keep up, I think, all that time.
The text pretty much, I think, dictates that general sound.
Yeah. Well, it did this time. Now, you know, I have some questions here. It crosses my mind. I wonder if the writers and Henry Ford dreamed this up. Is there really a Bert Levy? The Jews that they have are all named Levy.
Levy. I don't think they invented them.
So he actually goes before these women's councils and B'nai B'rith lodges and.
Well, sure. Why not?
Talk. Yeah. Okay. Except they're just, you know, so kind of perfect for what they want to say. But I suppose that in finding this.
Hello.
Yeah. Okay. In finding this, I guess they thought it was so good they want to use it. Now I wonder if they think that this would work good if Jews would become more like this, like the ones that this Bert Levy likes, the studious ones. But they're never all going to be that way because they never have all been that way. You know, even in the old country, in the old times, in the old days, they're never all this way. You also have the activist ones, the military ones, you know, the warriors, the political ones, dreaming up revolution and so on. So, I don't know what the purpose of this. It was fun to listen to it, especially the way you were reading it, but I don't know what it taught us. Except this thing about Kaddish, I will say that... it crossed my mind when they said that this is something that's said by orphans, no matter, I don't know if it said that or I just realized it was no matter what age, and that in these Holocaust survivor stories, they are always talking about how, when they were going to, you know, they were, especially in Elie Wiesel's story about when he and his father first got to Auschwitz-Birkenau, they were lined up and headed toward this pit of fire, you know, and then everybody, as they got closer and closer, the whole line of Jews started saying the Kaddish. And I thought it was something you did before you died. But they say it's something you say for your parents, and you're going to be an orphan. And you're an orphan. I think they consider you an orphan no matter what your age is. At whatever age your parents die, if you're 50 years old, you're still an orphan. Once your father or mother die, especially your father, I guess. And so then it made me think of the the Elie Wiesel and Buchenwald story, where if there was a Lazar Wiesel who was separate from Elie Wiesel, and he was sent over to the children's ward, even though he was 32 years old or so, after his father died in the camp, and that's how he got there, and that's how he got on the train to Buchenwald. That's a whole story about that. And this made it came to my mind that maybe it was more possible for that to have happened after all, because they consider, you know, in the Jewish world, you're considered an orphan, you got to be treated maybe specially or something after your father dies, even if you're a grown man. Anyway, what do you get out of this?
Well, he's complaining, of course, as I said, about the corrupting influence of American life. And there's a certain truth in that. I mean, you know, the kind of rampant materialism here. We don't get the kind of scholarship among our own people here that occurs, you know, for example, in Germany, right? You know, everybody here, if you're not making money off something, then you're not doing anything worthwhile. That's the American attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even in the academic circles, they expect to be well paid, and that plays kind of a big role. They don't sacrifice anything, those professors and so on. Doesn't seem to me, for the love of scholarship.
Well, you know, our academics are not terribly well paid for the most part in this country. We don't seem to really
put a high value. Well, so you mentioned Germany. Does Germany still have this tradition of these scholars, and are they very well, are they better paid than here in the U.S.?
I think they are.
Hmm.
You know, but in general, Germany has put a higher value on thinking. Americans have never put much value on thinking. Pragmatism is sort of the American way. We just barge ahead and figure out what we did later.
Well, there's a lot of energy in it. It's not all wrong. It's not all bad. A lot of, you know, good stuff comes from it. But that's right. That is the American style. Not deep thinkers and action. Taking action.
We do a lot of things that we should be regretting.
Well, anyway, we finished this chapter. I'm glad. I thought we might, it might be too long. And so next week, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be doing the next one, which is, I even got it here already, but I'm not going to find it now. The last one is an address. The last chapter is chapter 80, an address to Gentiles on the Jewish problem. And whatever next week is, we'll be here to do it. So join us. Good night.
Rage, aches, rage on, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.